This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's our Doctor in the House series. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. It's a Friday. How are you today, George?
I'm very good. I'm excited it's Friday.
I knew you were excited it's Friday, but
I'm also feeling a bit guilty that I had a bit of a hiatus not being here for a while. I promise not to take too many Fridays off.
Attending some concert,
You know, from now on, I'm going to take like proper weekend Saturday. Yeah. Do you want to go to Georgetown Festival
Such
over the weekend?
Such a distraction. No, George.
No?
I have a lot of other things to do.
Oh, Mira.
Festivals, concerts.
Yeah, midlife crisis.
Absolutely.
Why not?
Yeah, it's only you, not me. All right, so, you know, I have to say you were quite brave to come in and do this show because...
That's right.
The title of the show is The Good Doctor.
What
makes a good doctor? I mean, if you ask a doctor and a member of a public, you probably have different views as to who a good doctor really is.
Yes.
And
I'm very, very excited to do this. And of course, I'm, you know, like you said, a bit brave to be put on the spot, being scrutinized to what is being considered as good. However, I actually... one of the ways that we want to select medical students on entry point from sixth form to university actually asks this question, how do you define a good doctor? I think really that's a good way to see an insight of a medical student about where they project themselves in 5, 10, 20 years from the point of entry. And then that's really why I feel that I, you know, I'm quite interested to hear what our experts or panelists had online and it talked about,
you know,
and also the conversations with Klang Valley.
Yes. You know what? You're going to be wearing two hats today next to our two guests today. You are going to be the old doctor and you're going
older.
To be older.
Ola, okay, la ola.
Compared to them, yes. Yeah. Old. And you're also going to be that university lecturer, right?
That's correct.
You lecture at a private university. And so you're going to wear those two hats.
Exactly.
So joining us today to discuss the good doctor and what makes a really good doctor are Dr. Vigneshwaran Sivasubramaniam and Eunice Lim Yu Ying from the Malaysian Medics International. Welcome to the show, both of you. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having us. It's Mira and George. Hi.
Okay. You just want to quickly tell us, what is the Malaysian Medics International?
Right, sure. Yeah. So Malaysian Medics International is this non-profit organization that me and a bunch of my friends started 6 years ago. So at that time, I was in my 30th medical school. A bunch of my friends from the United Kingdom started this movement. So basically, we wanted to create a platform to connect Malaysian medics from around the world. The reason being, we felt that a lot of changes happen in Malaysia, but those medical students and doctors across the country, they do not realize or they are not aware of the changes. So we just wanted to create a platform that we can connect, educate and cultivate the Malaysian medics worldwide. So that is how Malaysian Medics International was started. So currently I have a chapter in the United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, India, Russia, and also Egypt on the way. And there's, of course, Malaysia there. So MMI is different in the sense that we are not like a political party, sort of organization. So we don't have members. I don't have picking passive members. So we get medics who are passionate about some projects or things that they want to work on, and we work together and try to solve the issue.
Okay,
that's how MMI has been functioning.
Sure. And so you, Vic, are at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at the moment. You do your master's in public health program?
A master's in global health, actually. I started this. I felt that in medical school training, we are given the classical education, all that. But I felt that there was something lacking in my training. I wanted to get the bigger perspective or see the bigger picture. So that is why after completing my medical school, I got myself enrolled into this program. It's actually a distance learning program. So I study online. I go for courses and take lectures online. And then it's for the exams every year.
Okay.
So it's actually master's in global health policy.
Sure. And you're a house officer in Hospital Kuala Lumpur.
That is correct.
Can I just make this clear? House officer is a houseman?
That's the same thing, yes.
Okay.
So I felt that house officer, is a better term, is gender neutral. Calling someone houseman, they're also women.
House women.
Right. Yeah. So house officer sounds better.
How politically correct.
I just wanted to make sure, because we know house officers is housemen in this country. So just so everybody's aware that when we say house officer, we're actually referring to the young doctor, young doctor.
Mm-hmm. The first 2 years after you get the DR in front of your name.
That's correct.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Used to be 1 year.
Mm. Oh, now it's 2 years.
That's correct.
Why they have doubts about you guys?
probably the older ones were not performing. I think because in the past, it used to be a medical attachment for 6 months and surgical attachment for 6 months. And then other non-medical, non-surgical, for example, psychiatry, gynecology, don't really get that sort of platform for new doctors to experience. So therefore, 2 years for them to experience it so that they can commit themselves to a career lifelong. And I think that's a good thing. Okay. However, that probably extend the training a little bit.
How long have you completed, Dr. Vic?
So I have one more posting to go. I've completed 18 months. So yeah, 18 months of my training. So and another 4 months, I'll be completing my housemanship.
Sure. And how is that divided? Like first six months?
So 4 months for each posting, and there are 6 postings I need to complete. So 5 are mandatory and 1 elective posting. I'm currently in my emergency posting, which is the elective one. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we have to go through medicine, surgery, pediatrics, obstetrics and gynecology, orthopedics. These are the mandatory ones. And elective, either anesthesia, emergency medicine, psychiatry or primary medicine.
Okay. Primary care. All right. And what happens after the 2 years?
So after completing 2 years, with the current system, I'm taken into the system as a contract doctor. So I need to serve for another year as a floating medical officer until I get I do not know whether I'll get a permanent job or I'll get a contract job again as a medical officer. So that is something that the Ministry of Health has been working on. So currently, effective 2016, so all doctors, all health officers are hired in contract system.
Okay.
So after completing 2 years, some would be absorbed with a permanent job and some would continue for another 2 years in a contract job.
Right.
After which, some would be retained and some would be let go of.
Oh.
Yes.
Eunice, does that scare you? It sounded like awfully complicated.
I always felt the government, once you get in, you're in.
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore. And Eunice is a fourth year medical student.
Yeah. A fourth year medical student at RUMC. Yeah.
And you want to share, you know, your thoughts on coming out. How long more do you have before you complete the degree?
Well, I have 2 more years. And I suppose going back to MMI and in general, I think we've moved forward to trying to make it into more of a advocacy platform and to just give people from the junior side of things a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And from our perspective, because we... having a platform to connect the students in Ireland, for instance, and then having that platform together with, say, MMI UK, we're able to share ideas on how different systems may work.
Mm-hmm.
And using that as an opportunity, like having worked with MMI for, say, the last 2.5 years. And of course, I think a lot of us would know that, you know, when medical students go overseas to study and they actually think of staying there.
Mm-hmm.
And then with, say, the system tightening up in the UK or Ireland year after year, if changes...
You may not have that guarantee.
Yeah, we won't. And, you know, being faced with that, we constantly discuss how it's like to work in the UK, in Ireland and in Malaysia. We also constantly discuss how it's like to be training in UK, Ireland and Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want to know what's best for us and we want to plot how to go forward, etc.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So you give a voice.
Yeah.
You know, George, you had
it's been a long time.
Yeah, you had it easy.
I can...
But you didn't have a voice.
We didn't have... I mean, from the sound of it, they... Vignesh Arnold automatically said founding person of the organization clearly created 3 platforms. Number one is a platform to network with international medical students. The second platform is to share ideas about sharing knowledge, how to progress in different demographics.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing is perhaps when the organization gets bigger, then that voice can be conveyed to bigger organizations like Malaysian Medical Association and so on and so forth. Correct, we didn't really have that sort of platform. In the old styles of training, it was very old, kind of old boys network. And I mean old boys, I put the boys in the big capital B because in the old days, 80%.
There were more boys.
There were more boys. Now we have more female entry in medical school. We have about 60% women in medical school.
What happened to the boys?
Phased out. The
selling burgers.
That's right, selling burgers. The ladies actually do a lot better in A levels for the entry, and then and also presumably a lot more. A lot less prohibited from going into medical schools, because in the old days, you would imagine that only men become surgeons, but now there are a huge number of great surgeons who are women, and therefore they're inspired to do that. And then more and more girls decide to become doctors.
Eunice being one in possibly 2 years' time.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Well,
progressing to that direction. Yeah.
You know,
there are multiple steps to get to that direction.
Yeah. Everybody wants to go there, isn't it? The Royal School of Surgeons. Right.
The interesting thing, which is very unique to UK, is that over here, all the parents are expecting you to progress to a career where you get a DR in front of your name. Mm-hmm. As soon as you become surgeon, you lose that DR and become Miss or Mr.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, in this country, we don't kind of like...
I've always wondered why. Yeah. Can someone explain to me why?
Well,
Mr. George would be the best man to there.
That's right. Yeah.
Dr. George.
Mr. George.
Mr. Yeah. Professor, excuse me. All right. Okay. No, in the old days, the surgeons were barbers. And then, so the barbers were misters. And then, so in the Royal College.
What do you mean by barber?
Barbers, like, you know, hair cutting barbers. And then, yeah. So they were not properly, kind of like a not medical associated training and so on. So therefore, whenever a surgeon who actually went through the medical training become doctor and then subsequently subspecialised in the surgical skills, and then that was supposed to be the kind of like a next level up, and then to become a mister or miss.
Yeah. Can you explain where the barber comes into this equation?
Yeah, okay. Yes, because we're the knife-using people.
Scissors. Thank you.
That's right.
Okay. So you want to bring a voice, an advocacy and a voice for the younger doctors. Do you think you've made much of an impact since MMI came into being?
We're slowly getting there, but we have managed to make some impact, I guess, at least in getting more Malaysian medics to speak up. So something that has always bothered me is that I feel people should always address things that affects them. When it goes chop up, people can see the bigger picture, but they're not experiencing the issues. They wouldn't know what exactly someone is going through. So that's why sometimes issues that affects the bottom people is not heard or misrepresented.
Would you like to highlight one or two issues that you're advocating?
Long waiting periods for medical graduates. This is always highlighted in the media. Everyone is always concerned about that. So let's take my story. I had to wait for more than a year to get a job.
That's quite a typical story.
Yes, atypical.
To be a house officer.
But an atypical thing that happened to me was that I couldn't get a job because I didn't have SPM. I went to an international school and the government wanted me to have SPM. So I was required to take SPM before getting a job.
History and Bahasa Malaysia.
I had to take six subjects because in order to get a CGL, you must sit for six subjects and pass history and Bahasa Malaysia. So this was not brought up previously when I was studying in medical school. So these are the changes that happen. So new changes happen suddenly and people get affected.
So changes happened when you were in medical school already?
This change happened after I graduated.
Right.
So, yeah.
And how do you think your voice can influence that?
Well, what I did was... so I managed to bring up Korean awareness at least. That was one thing that I was able to do. I used my study to inform the Malaysian medical community that this change has happened. So at least those back home or those overseas can be better prepared. Mm-hmm. So more Malaysian medics are aware of this. We were also able to bring this up to the Ministry of Health. And they were able to advocate for us. Because this issue is not because of the Ministry of Health, but because of JPA. So in order to become a doctor, you have to be a civil servant. And these requirements are set by JPA, not by the Ministry of Health. Ministry of Health is aware of all these things.
So is anyone listening? Obviously, you highlighted something that is very real and affect many people and your peers. You know, can they potentially be changed because of your voice being conveyed?
Upsets me a little is that we tend to be very reactive, but we're not proactive. So we don't try to prevent things from happening, but we only respond when things get hurt, when things go to the media or when an issue happens. Mm-hmm. It's only then that we tend to respond. And I don't think that's the right way to go forward.
So has much changed? Is that requirement still there? You still
that
need
requirement
to have...
is still there.
So what's Eunice going to do? You have SPM.
Eunice has SPM.
I have SPM, thankfully.
So she's safe, so she doesn't need to do anything. Okay, but coming back to early on, Vignesh, you mentioned something which is, I think, will be interest to many listeners out there. Of course, we come across many young doctors who are not getting into the program. Some are waiting for a year on average. Some are waiting for more than 2 years. Some give out along the way. Mm-hmm. And can you please highlight for the benefit of listeners exactly why is this happening, and also what is the current status, and also what is your voice going to change?
Right. So according to the Medical Act, so all doctors in the country has to be trained, given proper training, and that's where horsemanship comes in. So they must be trained by the government to ensure that they are safe and competent doctors. The issue is that the Ministry of Health, the government has to control and oversee this training, and there are limited roles. So what happened is that, well, there's a freeze in creating new positions by the government. Mm-hmm. This has been there for more than 5 years already. So we're not creating new roles, but replacing them. So when one person leaves, another person gets to replace that role, that position. So that is why there was a delay. 2 years ago, before this came up with the contract system, there was a long gap. People had to wait for up to 2 years, because if somebody does not complete within 2 years, so he's stayed back, and then a backlog happens because of that.
Is it fair to understand the status? It's not just about the freezing. It's that we're training way too many medical students as well.
That's right. So we do not have any statistics available to say how much position is available in the Ministry of Health, in the ministry to support us, the doctors. Mm-hmm. So because we do not know the numbers, we are unable. So there's an overproduction. I do not know whether it's
so there's a disparity between the number of people being produced by the medical schools, mm-hmm. and also a lack of positions in to train the doctors, right? That's a huge waste of resources, and you know, for both parents, for the time of the medical students who went through it, and a lot of anxiety. I mean, we had ministers who come on the shows to say that that will resolve accordingly. And you're in the hot seat, you know, facing that 1 year of joblessness.
That's right.
And despair. I mean, can you just explain a little bit how you overcome that kind of anxiety, or whether you get a job or not, and how your peers overcome that period? Because you're effectively unemployed.
That's right. It is hard. With our medical training, the training that we undergo just prepares us to be doctors. It's not a holistic training. With my medical degree, I am not trained to do an admin job. I cannot do human resource job because I'm not trained in that. So
you can always learn it.
I can always learn. That's, you're right. But then my medical knowledge goes to waste.
Absolutely.
That's what many of us feel.
I have come across medical students who did not want to be dependent on their parents, mm-hmm. and I started doing Grab driving, and then started working in restaurants to make ends meet. And that is the last thing your parents anticipate 6 years of training in medical school with all that investment ended up doing, right? Eunice, does that strike fears down your spine when you hear about when you need to have that competition?
We'll come back and find out from Eunice up next after the break. But if you have a question or you want to share a story, if you're a young doctor, give us a call. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll come back and find out more about, you know, young doctors and what makes a good doctor. Does medical school really prepare you to be a doctor? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me, joining us also from the Malaysian Medics International, Dr. Vigneswaran Sivasubramaniam and Eunice Lim Yuying, talking to us about the advocacy work and, you know, the sort of voice they bring for, you know, the young doctor. And what we're trying to find out is how far this voice actually goes. What are you championing? There's so many issues that face house officers in this day and time. One is you can't even get a job as a house officer because we have trained too many doctors. You know, I always hear a lot of lecturers. I mean, George, and you can tell me mm-hmm. whether this is true or not. A lot of kids actually don't want to be doctors, but their parents want them to be doctors. Do you see many of those kids, George?
My very first lectures, every time I kind of start the beginning of the semester or year, I would ask this question to actually say, you know, how many, don't worry, no, your parents not watching. How many of you actually want to be here, or how many actually have to be here? And then you would see at least 10 to 20% will own up and say, well, I actually didn't know what to do, and parents kind of nudge me into doing this. Well, I think one of the things that I want them to realise is that they're in that position already. It's not I don't want them to be pessimistic, and then I want them to think of medicine as a wider subject, because medicine is not just about clinical medicine, which is what we conventionally think of doctors, because there are other issues like, for example, governance, you know, the business side of medicine, the research side of medicine, the teaching side of medicine. So whichever way that you look at medicine, there's something for somebody in there. So I always want them to be positive. A lot of the skills that they learned will eventually build a character, and that character is going to take them forward in their career.
Would you both agree?
Yes.
Did definitely. You both want to be doctors? I mean, your parents are not listening, I'm pretty sure.
Funny story, my parents never wanted me to become a doctor.
Same, actually.
Yeah.
And coming from an Indian family,
yes,
that's...
No, my parents wanted me to do finance so that I can go into the family business.
Right.
I pushed myself to go into medicine. So, yeah. So, my parents told me to go for it. And they said, if you feel it's fine, you can always go back at a new business.
Of course.
So, yeah. So, I guess that sort of happened in a way that I didn't have a stress that I need to please my parents. So... that stress was always not there for me. So that gave me the freedom to explore other things. And that is why I was able to go into MMI and do other stuff. Mm-hmm. So some people have to just focus and study. Medicine is hard. You have to study really hard. I did study hard too. But I didn't have the worry that, oh, I must get A+. I must do super hard for my scholarship and all that. So that really did help me. So I can venture and look into other opportunities which were not given in med school. As Mr. Josh rightly pointed out, medicine, there are a lot of opportunities in medicine, but we don't get that holistic training. Mm-hmm. Entirely, at least not with my curriculum, or at least local curriculum. Yeah, we thought about anatomy, physiology, about being clinical doctors, being good clinicians, but the other aspects are not totally taught to us, or not even exposed.
Explored.
Yeah.
Eunice, did you want to be a doctor?
I did want to be a doctor, but I don't think my parents saw me as a doctor since I was young. So I used to do a lot of co-curriculars in music. In fact, I was on BFM before for a choir. So there was always that kind of like direction going. And but I wanted to be a doctor, so they just let me do what I want. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so in terms of, you know, having a medical education that's a little bit more holistic, or at least a training career pathway that's a little bit more flexible, I would say, right? So I think the failure in the current situation also kind of stops people from being a good doctor, because as a good doctor, I think most would agree that you have to have an interest in, say, humanities, or, you know, how it's like to be human.
Compassion.
Exactly. And if a system does not kind of allow that kind of flexibility for people to venture into alternative things, you know, going into understanding business in a more holistic way, understanding things, the huge amount of things that are also related to the healthcare.
What's running in your mind now, George? Because you couldn't do any of that.
No, I couldn't. I mean, it's like my training was slightly different, because I started as a pharmacologist, essentially do research first. So I kind of looked at the academic part of medicine. So, you know, the whole topic today is, what is a good doctor? In the kind of like a conventional way, we looked at compassion, clinical skills, updating your clinical skills. However, whenever you look at doctors in a bigger picture, a doctor needs to obviously update your skills, be at least knowledgeable in that area of your expertise. The doctor also needs to teach, because an older doctor teaching a younger doctor, it's a responsibility. You know, if your skills is not passed to the next generation, it's always a problem. So sharing is an important aspect. And in these days, like early on, we talked about self-auditing, and then that sort of issues are very important as well. So I'm quite interested to hear these two young doctors about how do they define as good doctor? Mm-hmm.
Who is a good doctor? Well, you spoke about teaching, George. I mean, there's a lot of talk out there. I mean, there was a Malaysia Kini letter that lamented that house officers are not empowered during their training, and therefore they're not equipped to handle the responsibilities of being a medical officer. What are your thoughts on that? They talk about bullying. They talk about, you know, the trust deficit, coping with the system, you know, all sorts of things.
That's a lot, but that is one individual's opinion that does not reflect everyone's thought. I do not agree entirely to that, because that letter was by an individual person of what they went through. I do not think that reflects or represents everyone's training. That's something unique about medicine. Everyone goes through a different journey. The patients we see is different. The training and the exposure we get is very different. My story is different from Eunice's. And it's very difficult to compare and say, yes, that happens to everyone. But having said that, there are a lot of shortcomings still in the system that can be improved.
Such as?
For instance, our training, horsemanship training that I have to go through, it is... There are a lot of people there. It's very huge. So it's very difficult to monitor them. So some people, we always talk about competency, but monitoring competency becomes difficult. So we're just given a piece of logbook and you're expected to complete that within 4 months. So by hook or crook, you have to complete it. And some actually do the things there, some don't. Mm-hmm. So then that makes me question the competency of the doctors. So in order to complete and come out in time, you sometimes you have to cheat. That is not right. Mm. So... Is someone who cheat a good doctor? Is that a quality that you want in a doctor?
Because of the lack of seniors.
Yes, that's right.
Senior doctors, not
there's
enough.
There's lack
to go
of opportunities.
Around.
I mean, there's only so much that we can do. So much that we can do in patients. Certain procedures, for instance, if you want to do a lumbar puncture, that's not something you can do on everyone. So limited opportunities, and the number is wide. So in order to get things done, people find other ways, and that's not right. And that's something that has always bothered me with the system.
Do we not have a lack of doctors in the outskirts or, in rural areas, for an example? And that's something I always hear, that, young doctors don't want to go out. Everybody wants to be in the city. If everybody wants to be here, then what happens?
Well, most perceive the training to be superior in the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do need doctors. And I think if we continue to produce the supply that we are providing, surely we'll be able to hit that mark. It's just the bottleneck that exists between having that supply reach that demand. And that bottleneck right now is still the horsemanship system, I would say, yeah.
Okay. Because we lack specialists, from what I understand.
We lack trainers.
Trainers. Yeah.
That's the other thing. We need specialists to train doctors, but not everyone can teach, but not all can reach.
Is that because of the brain drain of senior doctors moving from public to private sector, perhaps?
Perhaps, yeah.
Guilty, yes, guilty. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But you trained,
yeah,
George.
I do. It's probably not the vast majority of doctors who would do that, probably due to two reasons. Number one is that not everybody will be academically inclined. And secondly is that currently our private medical facilities do not necessarily allow or facilitate structured training for doctors, because many, many private patients are willing to have the presence of trainee doctors. However, the system itself prohibits that.
Okay, so the private sector can't get involved in
correct,
this.
Correct, yeah.
And that could be one option.
That's correct.
With this bottleneck.
Well, yeah, which it's in some countries, the private sectors actually do get involved in the training programs and then with the permissions of the patients. And then so Australia, for example, you have that options to learn skills in the private sectors.
Okay. What about this issue of junior doctors becoming burnt out? Mm. And when I speak to some of the senior doctors, they're like, oh, goodness, we went through worse. What are they complaining about, But what are your thoughts on burnout? Are you being overworked?
Vicky.
Tough question. I like working a lot, so it's fine with me, but our working hours are not that bad. Something that I've realized from talking to my friends and also from a few studies that I've done is that it is not about the amount of work that you do, but it's to do with the culture. Mm. Culture and the work environment. There still exists a culture of toxic healthcare work environment in the country.
What do
you
mean by toxic?
Undermining or using harsh tones. All this still happens. It still does happen in the country. And that affects people, and that can lead to burnout a lot more than being overworked.
Right. So it's an emotional, psychological side of things.
Yeah.
And but to be fair, George, I mean, you coming from the NHS, aren't you? I mean, burnout even there. It happens even there.
Yeah. Well, like you said, in the old days,
suck it up and just do it.
And then it's just like, this is part of the system. You can survive this. You can survive anything, which was the attitude. But what became a realization was that burnout would equate to unsafe practice, equates to costing life. And then hence, a lot of comparison is being drawn between pilots and doctors. If pilots have restricted hours to work in order to protect the safety of their passengers, why would doctor be allowed to work overtime? Hence, the European Time Working Directive came in, and the NHS system, they have some very specific rules about how many hours doctors are allowed to work so that they are considered safe.
So do we have guidelines as well now? I mean, our shifts, our house officers are no longer allowed to work more than 14 hours.
12 hours, effective January this year. So the Ministry of Health made it mandatory to ensure that no doctor works more than 14 hours. So we have new flexible systems, and that ensures that you do not go more than 12 hours and you do not do more than 2 on-calls in a week. So all that is good. But something that has always bothered me is that there are 2 things to horsemanship. There's work, service provision, and training. So we do not have proper definitions for this. So what would you consider as training and what is considered work? Because ultimately, we are still doing work. So we're getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
So what defines work and what defines training? Is me staying up late to clock 40 patients considered training, or is that just me doing the work because there's a lot of patients there? So that's
but how
the question
I've had. Why would that be a consideration in what context?
Well, one can question and say that could just be you misusing me to do work because there's a lot of patients. Whereas, how am I actually being trained by clerking 40 patients on a day? Is that really training? Am I actually learning something because I'm just randomly writing stuff, routinely asking the same thing, or getting new knowledge?
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it's a fine line between clerking essentially is taking history from patients and actually making sure that all the checklists are met so that patient is safe to undergo admissions. So in many ways, doctors can say that that clerking process is the communication with the patient and it's part of the training. However, when you just focus on that clerking and not really channel any part of skills, like for example, practical skills of catheterization, blood taking, then that will be a biased training. So hence, the idea of logbook comes in, hence the idea of a checklist of somebody needs to meet certain mandatory training before they can move forward. At the end of all that, actually, it's about implementation. Although we may have everything on paper, however, if the trainer doesn't take this seriously and trainees cheat or trying to have any shortcuts in order to achieve all these tick boxes, then the whole system will fail.
Okay. We have a message here via WhatsApp. I've been a house officer for the past 16 months and I've never felt as if I was part of the team. I always felt as if I'm the lowest form of life and have always had to do the small things and never been part of a clinical decision. It's as if the training in Malaysia is about ridiculing and bullying and shaming house officers in front of everyone. This is coming from Shamim. I mean, these are just thoughts, as you said, from individuals, right?
Sometimes even the smallest things matter. That's something I take great pride in. I know that very often I need to do a small job, but I feel that that small job I do is going to make a difference in that patient's life.
Fitness, obviously, you doing a lot of advocate work through the organization. If this was a member of your organization coming to you and say, this is how I feel about my future, this is how I feel about my current training, what are you going to do about it?
I get that a lot. It's a very difficult one to kind of say.
Well, I think as Vicky rightly pointed out in the beginning, one voice is just one voice. And what we've been trying to do, at least in the past year, is to do surveys. So Vicky ran a survey for housemanship, I think.
That's right.
In the last year. And then there is also a survey on workplace culture, but that is done with University of Malaya. Mm-hmm. So through those collective kind of, you know, when you hear the bigger picture and you see that this is actually a prominent problem. Say, for example, if you get statistics saying that 10% of people feel that they were at one point sexually harassed in the healthcare workplace. Mm-hmm. Well, then, that is going to be significant because the number, even if it's 1%, it should be 0 to begin with, right?
Indeed.
And then when I think it was close to around 50%, people who have felt, you know, undermined in any way or bullied in any way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that is the case at the moment. There's a lot of self-assessment and a kind of 360 assessment so that will protect both, you know, both parties. Both,
yeah. So what do you do with these, the outcome of these surveys? Do you share them with the right people so that something
right.
can.
So let me just give a quick overview of this study. So one thing that has bothered us is that the housemanship system has been going on for a long time, but it was never properly evaluated. Oh, I do not know if an evaluation was done, but there's no study available to say that, which is why we took up this project called National Medical Training Study in Malaysia. Mm. So in the UK, the GMC does this survey for the past 16 years. Every year in June, they'll send out a survey to all junior doctors, and they get to evaluate how the training is, and they can also evaluate their seniors and all that. And through that, they're able to improve, give suggestions to improve the system. We do not have that in our country. So the system has been in place, but no evaluation has been done. The logbook has not been updated for a really long time now. And that really bothered me. So I started a study. An issue is that we did not publish a study yet because the denominator or the sample size that we got was really small. So we only got about 400 participants who have replied to the study. Out of that, around 20% had said that they were being undermined at work. Meaning, you are only things like, you know, or you're just house officer, like you wouldn't know this, or, you know, questioning the knowledge.
More or less what the listener was highlighting.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So it does happen.
Sure. Dr. Asad is sharing, history taking is the most important part of making a doctor. A good history taking is half the treatment done. There you go, coming from a doctor himself. We'll come back quickly after the market update and continue this discussion on what makes a good doctor on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodhi, Dr. George Lee in our Doctor in the House series. We're discussing what makes a good doctor.
Mm-hmm. How's it going so far?
Yeah, I know, George.
It's a lot of reflection.
Yes.
I think. I mean, it is always healthy for a doctor to keep reflecting because it's such a long journey of your career that you reflect on what actually makes you tick and actually what makes you helping your patients.
With us also from the Malaysian Medics International, Dr. Vigneswaran Sivasubramaniam and Eunice Lim Yu Ying. Dr. Vicky is actually a house officer at the moment.
That's
finished
correct.
18 months, got another 6 months to go.
4 months.
4 months to go, right? And Eunice is a fourth year medical student. She's got two more years to go before she graduates and comes out and becomes a house officer. Fingers crossed, Eunice. But George, I mean, after listening to the young doctors or one doctor-to-be, has much changed?
Well, I think the what has been pointed out of all these lack of, you know, pessimisms amongst the lower rank officers in healthcare, I think it's because we still have this hierarchy system. Yeah. And then we don't have a system where there is a reporting system that the house officers are protected. In the UK, the house officers can bravely stand up and say, I've been bullied, and then actions will be taken.
Correct.
Over here, house officers probably don't feel as protected if they stand up and voice how they are not being trained or they are being bullied. I really think that hierarchy system, it's a cultural shift that eventually will get there. But at the moment, we are lagging a little bit behind compared to our overseas counterparts.
Okay.
I would just like to share, like, for instance, in Ireland, before every house officer is inducted into the system, they have to do a series of e-learning courses. And one of those e-learning courses are, like, appropriate behaviour in the workplace. So, for instance, well, like, the last week, so just a doctor, and he was kind of playfully just held my hand, like very garang, like, you know, why you don't know this, something like that lah. Well, he held my hand like that, but
it was unwelcomed.
It was unwelcomed. Okay, one can say that. I also know I like the doctor, like, as a mentor, he's fantastic, but that is not appropriate workplace behavior, right? And well, in Ireland, at least, you know, we are given an e-online course and people are very much aware
that there's a channel for you to vent that concern.
Not just that, but what exactly the definition of appropriate workplace behaviour is introduced right even before, you know, they got into the system. And that is, I don't know, I don't see that here. Well, I'm not saying that, like, you know, I know how things should be run and stuff like that. It's just more of like when I'm in a vantage point where I can see how two systems run, and then I see that things like sexual harassment or any form of harassment is, you know, reported. And
that sort of things is across the board, but it's more important in healthcare because professionalism had to be upheld to the highest standards in healthcare.
You're held to a very high level of integrity.
Sure. Michael, you have a question for us. How are you today?
Hi, Michael.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I have a few comments to make regarding the topic that we have been discussing so far today.
Sure.
Regarding the culture of bullying among being a houseman being bullied at work, I do agree that, you know, there are these kind of culture, at least in our training, our government hospital, because I have seen my colleague using some very nasty words towards health officers.
Mm-hmm.
But then in general, I wouldn't say that, you know, everybody behaves like that. So I would probably say it's really depends on who the person is, and it's very personal, you see. So,
okay, good point.
But in general, I would say that not everybody behaves like that. And on the topic of doctors burnout, you see, our health officers are now working in a shift of not more than 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
But this policy has been implemented because of a very, I would say, a knee-jerk reaction by the government towards the complaints by parents as well as health officers. But when they progress to become a medical officers, they would be actually doing on-call, and it would subject them to be working at least, you know, 20, more than 30 hours a day. So per shift, I mean, so I felt that measures have to be taken to actually prepare them to face their future in the medical line.
Okay. Yeah, are you a house officer yourself, Michael?
No, I'm a specialist now.
Okay, nice. Fantastic. Thank you for
your comment.
For calling. There you go.
You have an interesting perspective here.
He caught me at parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Parents and house officers are complaining. Parents, what's going on here?
It's sad, right?
Very.
Yeah, that's unfortunately the culture. Parents complain because, well, that's our culture. Parents care about us. We are not an individualistic culture.
Parents feel guilty.
Yeah, so parents feel guilty. Or parents worry about their children's well-being. Mm-hmm. So they complain. They ask, why are you not coming back home at this time?
But I think Michael has a point. If the harsh reality later on is that you will be required to work very long hours, then should you not be getting prepared for it?
My counter question to that, why should the medical officer be working 30 hours? If you're producing so many doctors, why are we not working on changing and improving the working hours of medical officers? Why are we making them work 30 hours and justify by saying that this housemanship long hours are to train them for that? Instead, why not work on improving those working hours for the medical officers? So we can ensure that we get better training, better service.
Well, at the end, compromising on the hours will compromise on the training, because you can't have both. You want more training, but yet you want less hours. So you're right, a structured allocations of time, manpower, eventually you'll get there. I think Ministry of Health were a bit caught off guarded whenever they're supplied with so many people. And I think we really had assurance from Ministry from multiple shows in the past that eventually it will equilibrate. But at the moment, we're just at that bottleneck, like you said.
Okay. We have some feedback here from Dr. Noor Rahman. She says, I'm a medical teacher, and listening to this discussion gives me much hope for younger doctors. When I see sarcasm going around my ex-students through Instagram feedback, I would quickly send a short text asking how they're doing as house officers. And I noticed that the sarcasm is one of the earliest signs of burnout. The senior doctors that thrive on sarcasm also send out signals of burnout themselves, even when they try to put a brave face. That the change of work culture, social norms and attitude have to be managed by everyone, the leaders in this fraternity and the society in general. Thinking that the situation can be resolved with time without doing anything different is naive of us. A good doctor, like any good person, flourishes in an environment that they feel supported. Hence, our system needs to improve with better voice given to all parties, junior doctors included. Well said, Dr. Noor Rahman. Thank you for that. And to think that she sat and typed all of that out on WhatsApp, that really took a lot of time. Right. Thank
she
you very much.
Stopped her car somewhere and then kind of did that.
Right. Just felt she needed to get this through.
Well,
you know,
from Dr. Noor Rahman, I actually highlight. I think two things that comes out. I think teamwork is one of them that actually should really supporting each other. And the second thing that I think it's important here is respecting each other. You know, the both the senior and the doctor and the juniors actually have integrity and professionalism that respect each other.
Okay, we're running out of time, but what do you think makes a good doctor? Very quickly, the both of you.
Something that we were not able to discuss much on is the patient's perspective. Ultimately, it's not about me calling myself the good doctor, but my client, my customer, the patient is the one who gets to see whether I'm a good doctor or not. So what the patient perceives is what matters to me as a good doctor. If I'm able to make my patient feel better, if he's feeling good, he's happy with my service, then I guess that makes me a good doctor. That is something that I want to see. That was actually the issue that I wanted to highlight from in this session, actually. What is the patient's feelings on all this, on this training, being clucked multiple times by different doctors? How does the patient feel about that? So that is something that I think matters. So instead of just focusing on the doctor and what they think is right, we should also bring in the patient's perspective into this.
I think I will again go back to commenting on the culture aspect, because as doctors, we are always told, you know, we are meant to treat our patients with respect, non-judgment, compassion, yada, yada, yada. But we don't give that same treatment to our colleagues. And when you are in an environment like that, how does that, you know, that goes back then into how does that empower the junior doctor to be a good doctor to you know,
respect
their patients.
Exactly,
yeah. And like Vicky and I were just discussing earlier today, like, we pick up role models along the way, and some people just end up picking different role models, right? And if there are any form, any kind of behavior, for instance, like anything that is inappropriate, that is not spoken up against, you know, that's allowed to continue, and that person will be a role model to someone else. You know, someone might think that that's appropriate. Maybe, you know, that doctor is excelling in other things, and they might pick that person as a role model, but, you know, they will carry on wrong societal attitudes, wrong social values.
George, in your time when you became a doctor, you were pretty much
25
years ago. I mean, you almost were like godlike, because we didn't know much about medicine. But, you know, we know a lot more today.
We have
Google.
We
can get educated about these things. And that's changed.
Yes.
You're no longer that godlike figure.
Because knowledge is not this democratized.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, does that change how you feel about you being a doctor and how people treat you, patients?
Well, I think there are two ways of looking at it. Some people are defensive. Some people are accepting. I really think to accept the that doctors don't know everything, it's a very important part. I really think, you know, one word that I would sum up what makes a good doctor will be empathy. It's not empathy towards your patient alone. It's empathy towards your junior colleagues, your nurses, your other colleagues, empathy towards the managers, empathy towards the government. It's about where you put yourself in the same shoes, just like how you treat your junior staff with respect. If you put yourself in their shoes, facing all that difficulties, these the anxieties and everything, then how expect to be treated that way, and when you put yourself in that shoes. And I really think that is a good way of defining what a good doctor should be. If you can put yourself in other people's shoes and behave the way that you want to be treated, then eventually you'll become a good doctor.
So the MMI is organising the Malaysian Medics Summit 2019 on the 20th and 21st of July. And the theme is the good doctor. Is everybody invited for this?
Yes, everybody is invited. It's free of charge for the general public. Our aim is to improve the doctor-patient relationship. Over the past year, there were many issues highlighted about the medical fraternity in the media. Some were good, some were not so good. So what we hope to do is create a better awareness of what's happening in the healthcare industry so that public can understand and respond better.
Okay, fantastic. So,
and
all the best.
This is going to be held at the Publica Shopping Gallery.
Fantastic. So all the best for the 20th and 21st of July. And thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Vigneswaran Sivasubramaniam and Eunice Lim Yu Ying from the Malaysian Medics International, together with Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in our Doctor in the House series on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.